This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Ben Gideon. Rahul is off today, and we're excited to have Xander Blewett joining us from Montana. As I was mentioning to Xander before we went on the air, ironically, Rahul is on vacation in Montana and probably could have driven over to your home or your office, Xander, and done this in person if he felt so motivated. Although I don't know, he's in the Big Sky area, and are you in Great Falls?
Great Falls, right. A couple hundred miles away.
Yeah, Montana, like Maine, where I'm from, is a pretty big state, right?
Oh, fourth biggest and probably the least population, 1 million people.
Oh, is that true? For some reason, I assumed you had, we're at 1.3 in our state. I thought you had more people than we do, but guess not.
No, we don't have very many.
So we'll talk about that a little bit because it definitely creates challenges for our chosen line of work, but before we get into that, could you just tell the listeners a little bit about yourself? I've had the pleasure to get to know you just a little bit, and I had a really nice chat with your son at a recent meeting we were at, where he talked a lot about sports and wrestling. And I'm wondering if that's kind of part of your history and background. And also, he mentioned politics. The Blewett family is really deeply entrenched in sports and in politics, right?
That's correct. Well, let me just give you a little rundown. I was born during World War II in Wareham, Massachusetts, because my dad was in the Navy and we were back there. Then we moved back to Montana, and I've been here ever since. My dad was a lawyer. He was a defense lawyer, and I wasn't interested in his gig at all. So I was going to be a mathematician, and the space program disrupted. And so I decided to go to law school, and then I've been practicing since 1971, trial practice pretty much. And, but you're right. We are, my grandfather was in the House of Representatives in Montana. And then my dad was involved in politics. He was in the House. He ran for the Senate against Mike Mansfield and got beat 2-1. Those were in the days when Montana was Democratic, and now it's total Trump. I mean, it's 68% Trump now. And then Anders served three terms in the state legislature, one as a senator and one as a rep. But we're very interested in wrestling. I wrestled at Montana State. I wasn't very good, but I was very interested in it. Anders wrestled, and he was really quite good. And Drew, our other son, wrestled. But we've just followed, have been big supporters of wrestling throughout the state. Put on five or six years, we put on a post-state tournament, all-star tournament, which was a big hit, except after a while, kids didn't like cutting weight any longer, and the season, they were ready to be done. So we quit doing that. But that's pretty much the background. Our I practice with my two sons, Anders and Drew, both of which I think you met at one of our meetings. And then we have Joel Cosgrove, who's another lawyer in our office, been there a long time. So we just do a lot of trial work. And in Montana, you got to make chicken salad out of chicken shit because they don't get very many cases. And that's kind of our gig, you know, a lot of insurance claims. Used to do a lot of railroad FELA stuff and crossing cases and just across the board. But used to be lots of trials, not so many anymore, but because of COVID. That's pretty much your background.
So we were just in the market for another lawyer to join our firm, and we interviewed some folks, and we ended up hiring somebody who his signature best qualification, in my view, was that he was one of the top wrestlers in his weight class in our state back when he was in high school. And, you know, I figured that quality demonstrates something about his character and his personality and a willingness to sacrifice and work hard and be competitive and goal-oriented. Do you find that there's that sort of parallel between being a trial lawyer and what it takes to be a good wrestler?
Oh, very, very much so. I think the discipline is a big thing. Discipline is doing what you don't want to do when you don't want to do it. That's trial work. That's what we do. And just the competitiveness of it. You just have to outwork your opponent, and that's what trial work's about. So I think it's played a huge role in my career. As I say, even though I've just been a big fan of it, more so than a very talented wrestler. But yeah, I think it's a big deal.
You look like you could get on the mat right now, Xander. What was your weight class when you wrestled?
I was 137 pounds in college, and I'm probably 148 pounds now. But I'm keeping in very good shape, and that's another thing I think that's so important for trial lawyers to realize, that it isn't just the trial work that you need to concentrate on. You need to have a hobby. You need to work out and keep your health up. And a lot of us just kind of lose sight of that because we get into the pit and working hard and drinking a lot of coffee, a lot of booze. You're just way better off, I think, long-term if you keep yourself in good shape, whether it be running or mountain climbing. That's a big thing in our family. We climb a lot of mountains all over the place, and it's just a great exercise and good way to be with the family. And anyway, that's a hint that I have for trial lawyers, because I see a lot of them just don't pay attention to that aspect of their lives.
Yeah, and I think it's you can fail to appreciate how physically demanding the job is when you have to be on in trial on a day, you know, day in and day out. You really need stamina to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So back to the challenges of doing this kind of job in a state like Montana. Almost all of what I know about Montana, and probably many people, comes from watching Yellowstone. Have you watched that show?
No, I haven't. But I'm very familiar with, you know, Kevin Costner doing it and where it is and those kinds of. But here's the thing about Montana that's kind of interesting and scary. We have 56 counties. We have the Rocky Mountains run right through the western one third. So we live just on the east side of the Rocky Mountains. The west side of the Rocky Mountains is is more of a green, mellower climate. It's still all cold weather, but then from the Rocky Mountains east there's a lot of mountain ranges out there, but there's a lot of plains, a lot of agriculture. So if you were to bring like a medical malpractice case, venue is paramount. I mean, it is the number one issue, because there are 50 counties that you couldn't even begin to to bring a medical malpractice case in. They have one doctor in the county, and the people are so afraid they're going to hurt the doctor. I mean, you just can't get a fair shake. So you would never even think of bringing a medical malpractice case in those counties. So you're down to six, pretty much, maybe seven, but pretty close to six. And then any other case, even a car wreck case, is awful tough in those 50 counties. I mean, you're just not going to do very well. You're going to get a lot of people that just aren't interested in the program, you know. So you got a venue is a huge thing, and that's a tricky part of our practice.
Are you seeing that change at all, or is there a trend in any direction, or is it pretty much the same as it's always been in terms of what's good and bad, the good and bad counties?
Yeah, it's probably worse because of the Trump effect, because all those counties, those 50 counties, just love the concept of Trump. But that hasn't changed. If we looked at those 50 counties, you'd probably find five or six plaintiff's verdicts in those 50 counties in 100 years. It's tough sledding. You just don't want to be in those counties. So there's always some way that our venue law here is pretty fair. I mean, you can sue a defendant. Say there's two defendants and they're in two different counties. You can sue one of the defendants in a proper county and haul the other defendant into that better county. Whereas if you had to sue them in Roosevelt County, back east, eastern part of the state, it wouldn't work. That's a big ingredient in a lot of our cases. Another thing about Montana is we have some pretty good underinsured motorist law. I mean, a lot of states, you know, you have offsets for what the liability carrier paid, and, you know, just a lot of coverage issues. So we're pretty good on that. And that ends up being a number one criteria you look at when you get a car wreck case. You know, you're going to take a really close look at UIM coverage or UM coverage. That's just a big part of our practice.
So despite the challenges you faced in doing this trial practice in Montana, you've had amazing success throughout your career and have a number of extraordinary verdicts, of which you spoke about several during the recent meeting that we attended together. And some of them are just really interesting and fascinating. But at the end of it, and we'll get to some of the specific cases, you've been so amazingly successful in your career that now, as I understand it, the state of Montana law school is now named after you. So you're very humble, but at the end of the day, you found a way to make your trial practice incredibly successful, even in a really difficult venue. How do you think you managed to do that when it's, you know, so I would imagine so few people have accomplished that in that state?
Well, there's a couple of factors, I think. One of them is the stock market. If you were conservative in some of those years, and I don't know that I made all that much money. I made a lot of money, but I don't know if I made enough money to have the law school named after me because of the gift. But careful investing was a big help, because if you just took your earnings from the law practice in Montana, you're just not going to amass too big of a nest egg. So that's number one. And number two, I had a yearning to try cases. Lots of guys don't. I mean, lots of people just don't like the contest. They don't like the feeling in their belly. But from wrestling, I think I kind of had the mindset that I really liked it, and I wanted to try as many as I could because I thought I'd get better the more I did. And that ended up being correct. But so I tried a lot. a lot of differing types of cases. And the way the law school thing came around in 2015, I wanted to give some money to the law school. See, I went to MSU in Bozeman, Montana State, and then I went to undergrad. That's where I wrestled, and that's where my allegiance is. And then I went to law school at the University of Montana, and we wanted to help out the law school. And the dynamic was that we had to have some way to try to keep. We used to have a very good professor that taught torts and insurance and those types of things. And we thought it would be important if we could get a consumer law program going at the University of Montana. So we ended up giving $10 million, but $3.2 million of that was to chair a consumer law professor. You need to do that to have a chair funded. You need to give that money up front. And that's just been a great success. And so we were the second law school in the country to have one of these consumer law programs. And one of the things they do is they teach consumer law, which we're all interested in. And the other thing is that there's money available now for when kids leave law school after their freshman year and they can't find law work, or they can find a job that's going to pay them a pittance. So they leave the law and go work construction or do something. And this program we've set up is they can go to the eastern part of the state and get paid very well to work in a county attorney's office or help with a public defender, those types of things. And so the law school is a real bargain it's in a beautiful location in Missoula. It's probably in the country, it's probably the best bargain for what you get as far as bar passage rates and finding jobs and those types of things. So it's been a great deal, and it just kind of worked out. But I give more credit to the stock market than I do to my trial skills and money earned from that.
We can cover stock tips on the next episode of the show. But so I remember you talking about early on in your career, I think you did, maybe you started on the defense side or something.
Yes, I did.
Can you tell us that story? And then you switched over. I think you may have had some fight with the plaintiff's lawyer and then went over to the other side, right?
Yeah, well, here's the way that went. Once I got, my dad was in this law firm, a big defense law firm, and he was in the American College of Trial Lawyers. He was a good lawyer, and I went with him, and we got to try a lot of cases. But I was starting to, I didn't feel very good about doing the defense stuff. And I was kind of a cowboy, kind of was willing to roll the bones with their money. I just wasn't a very good defense lawyer. I just had the wrong mindset for a defense lawyer. And there was this one case. It was a aircraft crash, and it was Daisy Wagner versus Piper Insurance, Piper Aircraft. And I defended it, and we went to trial. And this was a beautiful gal that was hemiplegic from a chance fracture about L4-5. And it was a very serious injury. And when the verdict came in, I looked over at this gal, and I just felt pink. And I decided, I'm getting out of this. So in the meantime,
can you tell us about when that happened? What year?
That was 1980.
Wow. And I can tell that really sticks with you even to today, because when you talked about it, you get emotional.
Oh, right. I do. It was a big turning point. No question about it. And the other thing about that case was I always felt that the plaintiffs brought the wrong case. They clitobral performance case, because this I don't know how many folks had aircraft cases, but this was in Butte, Montana, which is 5,500 elevation, and it was a 78-degree day, and they had a Piper P-28, which is a low-performance airplane, and they had the gas right. They didn't have too much gas, but they had four passengers, and the performance sheet on the airplane said it would make it, and it didn't. And not because of pilot error, it just didn't quite have the oomph, the performance. And I always thought that was the much better case. And they brought a crashworthiness case, which back in the 70s and the early 80s was the rage. I mean, everybody was bringing these, and there was, so their basis was it didn't have shoulder harnesses, manufactured in 1959, didn't have shoulder harnesses, which was a good theory, but we can poke some holes. So I won that case, and I felt bad about it. But in the meantime, there was a guy from Montana who was the indisputable king of torts. His name was John Hoyt, and he was just the best. He was leading the charge for everybody else, make a new law, getting all kinds of good verdicts. And I was defending a number of cases that he had. And we weren't getting along all that well, because I was actually getting the better of him some of the time. And one time we were arguing in the Montana Supreme Court chambers, and John could be a little volatile, but he got angry after the argument, because he had clearly lost the argument. And he wanted to fight. And I mean, as I said, I was a wrestler, but I wasn't much of a pugilist. And I was 40 years old. He was 23 years older. He had a little pot gun. He had these shiny cowboy boots. And so I said, yeah, okay, here or on the parking lot. And then his associate broke us up, and that was about the end of that. And then about a year later, after a couple other skirmishes in the courtrooms, he asked me to be his partner. And so that's in 1985, we became Hoyt and Bluick. And then unfortunately, he died in 2001, but we had 17 great years, and he taught me a ton. And it was a good deal.
That definitely sounds like a Montana version of trial practice, lawyers duking it out, though it didn't eventually come to that, fortunately. But so let me, I want to ask you about some of your cases. I mean, I don't know where you want to start. You want to go back and do the earlier ones, and or my memory of, you had two that really stuck out. One is the one involving the painting, which is a fascinating story. Can you tell us the story of that case?
The history on this is my best friend from junior high school and college, and then he lives in Great Falls after college. His name was Steve Seltzer, and he was an artist himself, but his grandfather, O.C. Seltzer, was an artist of some renown. And at the same time that O.C. Seltzer was painting Western art, Indians and cowboys and mountains and prairies, those kinds of things, Charlie Russell was kind of his contemporary, and they were friends, and their works were close, but close together. I mean, they looked, to the layman's eye, they looked similar work. But Charlie Russell had a wife, Nancy, that took him national, and he became very famous, probably the most famous Western artist at that time. And he lived in Great Falls, as did O.C. Seltzer. So his works were worth 10 times as much as O.C. Seltzer's. It just so happens that two people from California named Morton, who were kind of trust baby kind of people, didn't really have jobs, but had a lot of money. And they went out and bought a painting called Lassoing a Longhorn. And this painting was sold by the Kennedy Galleries, which is a major gallery, one of the most impressive, well-known galleries in the country. And they bought this painting and they held it for 30 years. And then they decided to sell it. And when they sold it, or they took it to the Coeur d'Alene art auction, and they said they got it, and they said, "Yeah, well, look, but we're going to take a look at it." And they said, "That's fine." So we took a look at it, and they called Steve Seltzer, who is O.C. Seltzer's grandson, and just happens to have spent his whole life studying Western art. He's an artist also, but he was the world premier expert on O.C. Seltzer paintings, and hence knew a lot about C.M. Russell. So this painting is worth $750,000 if it's a Russell, and $75,000 if it's a Seltzer. And so this art auction called Steve and Seltzer and said, "What do you think? Is this an authentic C.M. Russell painting?" And he said, "No, it's not. I'm familiar with the painting. That's my grandfather's painting. And it's had the signature had been altered. And so it said C.M. Russell on it." But anyway, so that's what he said. And so they wrote him a letter. And or they went to some lawyers at Gibson, Dunn and Crutcher and wrote him a letter and said, "Look, buddy, you either sign this affidavit and say that you were terribly mistaken and that this is a Russell and not a Seltzer. And if you don't, we're going to sue you for millions and bring the house down on you." So he wasn't about to budge that it was clearly not a Russell. And so they sued him. And we got the case thrown out. Actually, we were about to get it thrown out on summary judgment, and they dismissed it with prejudice. And then we sued them for malicious prosecution and abuse of process. And it was a fascinating case, because you went back into all these years, back in 1926 when Charlie Russell died, you went back, looked at all this work, and this clearly was not a Russell. I mean, it just was. It was an O.C. Seltzer. It was not a Russell. So in the meantime, we got a lot of information out of their law firm. And what happened is this Morton guy was a big-time socialite in Los Angeles. And he was the chairman of the big golf tournament they have down there, Ben. The big charity, can't think what the name of it is, but huge golf tournament with all the pros. And they wanted to curry favor with him. So the lawyer agreed to take the case. And then they ran it up the chain of command, and Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, 800-person law firm, and they said, "Yeah, I'll take that case." So they sued him. And we found some great stuff and had a trial in Great Falls, Montana. And the touchy part was compensatory damages. This was after the punitive damage cap of single-digit modifier or single-digit ratio of punitives to compensatory damage. So we had to get a lot of compensatory damages. And Steve had emotional distress, and that was about it. But we got $1.1 million in compensatories, $20 million in punitives, and it got reduced slightly because of the ratio. But it was affirmed on appeal. It was just a labor of love. It was quite a case.
Yeah, that's a fascinating case. And who represented Gibson Dunn at trial? Did they represent themselves, or did they?
Gibson Dunn had a guy named John Swenson, who was one of their top litigators, and he defended himself. And he had Montana counsel called Garlington, Long, and Robinson that were, they did about 50-50, but anyway, they were in the case. They were defending themselves. They had their fool for a client. It didn't work out very well, but it was...
Remind us if the listeners want to view this painting, lassoing a longhorn. A longhorn. How would somebody locate that painting today if they wanted to see it?
After the verdict was affirmed on appeal, Steve tried to buy the painting because he wanted to put it in the C.M. Russell Museum. Great Falls has a C.M. Russell Western Art Museum that is first class. It's for a town like Great Falls, Montana, it's really shiny. And Steve wanted to put it in the museum because it was just such a remarkable piece. It looked like a Russell, but if you knew what you were talking about, it was clearly not a Russell, so he wanted to put it in the museum. And they must have been a little upset about the verdict or something, so they wouldn't sell it to him. But he and I ended up getting possession of it 10 years later, and it now sits in the museum, and it's got a little vignette of the story. I mean, there's two things. It's a fascinating lawsuit, but societal-wise, it's a very important reminder to people, like cryptocurrency, all of these rages. There's a lot of art fraud, and it's very difficult. It's not like you have a title to your land or a title to your car. You've got the provenance, which is the history of the painting. And more importantly, you've got the style. And if the provenance is no good, you don't have a painting. More importantly, if the style doesn't fit the artist, it doesn't matter what the provenance is. It doesn't matter if it's in the most famous museum in the world, it isn't his work. And so those two elements played a huge role in the trial, because Steve Seltzer could say, well, no, just look at this. Right here, you can see that the sagebrush is very meticulously drawn because my grandfather was a machinist at the Anaconda Company, and he was very, very precise. Whereas if it were a Russell, Russell's magic was he could make it look like sagebrush when it wasn't sagebrush. He could just make a cloudy little sagebrush and you would think, oh, what a beautiful piece of sagebrush. Whereas O.C. Seltzer would just do this very delicate, very fine painting. And that was the big difference. But so that's where it is. If you're ever interested in looking at it or reading about this story, it's at the C.M. Russell Museum in Great Falls, Montana, of all places.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com. Tell us about you had a huge verdict in a grade crossing railroad case, right?
Yeah, we got a verdict in a case called Dorn versus BNSF.
And are those grade crossing cases, do you still see those today, or are those kind of a thing of the past now?
Well, there's been so much preemption, Ben. You can still bring them, but you need a circumstance like I'll tell you about in this case. Speed's been preempted. The price book funding preempts the cases. If they spent a dime on reflectorized tape on a crossbuck, that means, according to the Supreme Court of the United States, that crossing is safe. You can't say it's unsafe because they put reflectorized paint and use federal funds. So it's a very tricky preemption situation anymore. But in this Dorn case, there's a highway, and then there's a little road that would go over the railroad tracks and go to the elevator where all the farmers would take their grain and sell it to them. But when you left the highway, the road was on an angle of about 45 degrees. So when the trucker left the highway, everything's fine, and he starts angling toward the elevator, it's 45 degrees. So when he tries to look, he can look to the left very easily and see if a train's coming. He looks to the right, he's got a grain bin on his truck, and he can't see out the back window. So all he can see is that 45 degree angle. And the train's going 52 miles an hour, and you don't have any time. So in that case, you can say that the crossing is unsafe, unreasonably unsafe, because the sight distance is so restricted that nobody could see. I mean, it's just a great concept. So anytime you get a railroad crossing case, you want to look at the angle of the intersection of the road and the tracks. Because if that is not 90 degrees, which it should be, just makes sense, then you can see both ways and see if a train's coming, you can stop. But if it's 45 or even 60, you can't see. So that was how we got around preemption. This was a husband and wife, and they had a little baby, and he was just a hardworking farm kid. They met online, and just a wonderful story. But he got snuffed out big hurry when he gets by a train like that. So but that's what you want to look at in those cases. But crossing cases are tough anymore.
Tell us about the case you brought against the Southern Baptist folks. That's also a fascinating set of facts.
That's a very interesting case, and it's a good guide for people that are looking at the issue of whether you're in the course and scope and or whether there's insurance coverage. And in this case, the Southern Baptist Convention, it was called North American, it was called NAM, N-E-M-B. Anyway, it's the Southern Baptist Convention, and they proselytized, and they sent missionaries, young kids, to Montana, in West Yellowstone, Montana, and they would spend all of their time out trying to convince people to join the Baptist faith. That's what it was about. Well, when they were in Montana, they took a trip up to up way up north from West Yellowstone, and on their way back, one of the missionaries that was driving either fell asleep or something and rolled the vehicle and really, really hurt our client. I mean, he was really badly injured, as you can get. And Mike Parr, who died, he was from South Carolina, he got the case 2 days before the statute ran, and he immediately called me in Montana 2 days before the statute ran, and we had to figure out who all the players were, and we flew down to Bozeman and got the case filed. And the issue was, were they in the course and scope, which they denied? And there's also, when you get these course and scope issues on agency issues, it's very important to look at the language of the policy, because a lot of times, even if you're not in the course and scope, you might be an insured under their policy. So you want to take a real close look at that. Anyway, we went through, my son Anders and I took all of these depositions and found out all of this, of what they were actually doing and having these kids do. And it got down to the point that we got summary judgment on the issue that they were on the job all the time, because they have language.
Well, can you just, it's interesting because we're litigating a case similar to on summary judgment right now. It's the briefs have been filed, but so I'm really interested in this. What was their argument as to why they were not in the course and scope? Was that because as they were, where they were driving was not for the purposes of work, it was some extracurricular activity or just a commute back and forth to home or something?
Well, and that's why I say they tried to say the proselytizing was limited to West Yellowstone, which is down by Yellowstone Park. And they had gone this day to a family reunion in Flathead Lake, Glacier National Park, which is 300 miles away. And they were returning. So they were saying, well, it couldn't possibly be in the course and scope because they were on this venture with a family. And we were able to show, well, that's not quite right, because all of their literature and that we were able to get showed that these missionaries were supposed to be on the job proselytizing 24/7. And we were able to show lots of things that they were supposed to do. For instance, when they were in Glacier National Park, 300 miles away, they were going into campgrounds and talking to people and trying to talk them into going to church and how great the Baptist faith was. So we were able to get all of that evidence in to show that they actually were on the job 24/7. That's kind of rare. But their other defense was, and this might have been their best one, they were all very religious, and they were all interested in bringing people into the fold of the Baptist Church, whether they were in the job or whether they weren't. They just did that personally. They liked to do that. And that's what they were trying to say. But what happened is we took the deposition of the guy that was the head of the program at the time, this North American Mission Board, that's what it was called, Dan. And he ended up admitting that, yeah, these guys were on the job 24/7. And he had written a memo that said just that. We expect them to get their asses out there and do their job 24/7. Be thinking about this all the time. So that's how we were able to prevail on that. And they had $26 million in coverage, and we were going to trial in a month or 2 months. And we gave them the deadline, pay the 26, or we're going to go to trial. We're going to get 56. So have at it. So I'm out golfing with, I don't know why I'm golfing with this guy, but he's a right-wing Trump lover. And I got a call, and I said, yeah, hold on a second. I'll be right with you. I just take this call. And it was the defense lawyer, and he said, we'll pay the 26. And I said, okay, we'll take the 26. And we're reserving our bad faith case. And the Trumper said, 26, what? Because 26 million. And he was pretty bummed out about that. Anyway, that was another fascinating case, because, and something to keep in mind on these, when you get a case in 2 days before the statute, the inclination is to just get that baby filed. But you got to make sure you get all the players. It's hard to get the players in 2 days. So, and you also needed to get a player that was a Montana person to stay in state court. The federal court, the case would have been much tougher. A lot of religious folks out there don't want to hit the poor church and that type of thing. So, but when you get that case in, don't get trigger happy. Don't file it any sooner than you need to, because you have to get all the people. And that's a goal. But pay especially good attention to the language of the policy, because some of them say, if you're in the course and scope, you're covered. Other ones say, if you were doing, what you were doing was related to the business. And if it says course and scope, you may have a problem. If it says related to the business, that's a whole new game. And check that out. Lots of policies say, have that second language in there. Or related. So you might look at that, man, in your case.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because we were talking to Brent Walker on an episode, which probably aired a couple before yours, but I think he pointed out they do a lot of litigation against Uber, and there's the argument, a similar argument, that people are independent contractors and you can't get up to the company. But I think they may have determined that the insurance permits claims directly or covers drivers directly, even if you can't make the agency argument. So it's something that's definitely worth looking at in every case. And I made a note while you were talking to look at that in my own case mentioned where we're litigating this issue, because it occurs to me that I don't think it has that related to language, but we certainly want to go back and recheck that again.
And the other thing on these insurance cases is you need to look at that non-owned auto coverage. And a lot of times you're not paying attention to that, but the non-owned auto language varies company to company. And some of these really big commercial policies have a little different language than others. Yeah. Others on a lot of policies, just a regular car policy, will say non-owned auto means this, and it can't be used by the person if it's used 30 days in a row, and that's using it all the time, and so you're not non-owned and all those things. But a lot of times that language is pretty wide open and helps you in a course and scope situation, and that was a pretty big hit.
So now you practice with your two sons. That must be pretty gratifying to have both of your boys there and being able to work together on cases.
Yeah, super highlight of my life. It's just fun. And, you know, when they start, they don't know much and I'm the guru. And after a while, they're the gurus and they're telling me a lot of things that I hadn't thought about. And just for instance, here's one. We had a case in federal court in Butte, Montana, which the federal court is pretty tough. They have seven jurors and you have to, has to be unanimous. And one bad apple in the case is gone. So we're going through voir dire, and there's this one kid on there, and a guy my age that doesn't want that kid. I mean, just don't want him. Just viscerally, you don't want him. And Anders is sitting there as we're bored trying to decide. And he got a lot of Facebook information on him, and there were just some things about him that you just wouldn't know about, and you wouldn't have that feeling about him until you saw this stuff. And so we kept him, and it was a bingo. I had a boot bag guy, and we'd have had a problem. So this was an interesting case, because our guy and his wife, and best friend and his wife, they were like 70 years old, 68. They're driving on this road, and there's this truck in front of them, and he's going slow, and it's a passing zone. So they pass him, and right at the 11th hour, he turns left, and they have this horrendous crash, and two of them were killed, and it was a very tough liability situation. But we were able to show, because the guy kept saying that he knew, well, I knew exactly where this road was. And he was working for a helicopter company that did seismic work out in rural Montana. And we were able to show, when he said that the reason he had his signal on and slowed down and was doing those, he knew exactly where that little turnoff was. And we went out there with a ladder. And this is one of the few times you can get a rebuttal in, because they really did change. And it came up in their case, not our case. We couldn't anticipate this. So when you get a rebuttal situation, you got to be damn careful, because it has to fit within all these parameters. But we went out with a ladder and got out and got a prototype vehicle, and were able to show that this guy couldn't begin to see this road. He had no idea where he was going. He just, at the 11th hour, just turned. So we were able to win that, and we got a very nice verdict. But there's an example, then, of the young lawyer carrying the day when I didn't think they knew anything. They knew a lot.
Well, you've taught and mentored them well.
Yeah, they're very good lawyers, I know.
Well, Xander, as I anticipated, the hour has flown by. I really appreciate your joining us. And I mean, we could go on for another hour with more cases, but it's been really fascinating. And I appreciate your willingness to do this.
Yeah, I wouldn't miss it, Ben. Thanks for asking me.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.